This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. What was the last sports venue you visited? My guest today is the author of the new book, The Arena. Inside the tailgating, ticket scalping, mascot racing, dubiously funded, and possibly haunted monuments of American sport. Rafi Cohen is a freelance writer and editor. He served as deputy editor at the New York Observer and has written for GQ, Men's Journal, The Wall Street Journal, Town and Country, ESPN.com, and many more. He also lives in New York City, and that's where we're headed for this edition of Sports Jam. The Arena. It's about stadiums, but it's, as you put it, it's a book about around sports, not necessarily about sports. I like how you phrase that. Thanks for being on Sports Jam.
Oh, such a pleasure to be here.
When did the fascination begin with stadiums and arenas and wanting to know more about that?
Well, I've always been a sports fan. You know, I love going to games. But it was never just the games, you know, that excited me. You know, you'd show up and you'd see sort of the sidewalk merchants trying to sell you a T-shirt. You'd go through the crush of the crowd to get inside where the smell of all the foods would hit you. And then you'd walk out into the seating bowl and see that flash of green, you know, that first flash of green of the field. And you were just there, you know, and all of it was just so exciting. You know, fans high-fiving, fans fighting, the grounds crew raking the dirt, the mascots traipsing up and down the aisles, the vendors barking for your attention. It was just always, for me, it was always about all of these things, not just the game. And so this felt like a great opportunity to explore some of those underappreciated elements of the stadium.
One of the things that I really enjoy about the book, The Arena, is that you talk about the old-time stadiums as well as the new great stadiums like AT&T Stadium in Dallas. But, of course, you start off with Lambeau Field and you talk about Wrigley Field. You mentioned Forbes Field. I only went to one game at Forbes Field growing up in Pittsburgh, and I remember Freddie Patek for some reason. He was 5'5". He was the Pirate shortstop. That's about all I remember from that one game that I went to Forbes Field. But as I was reading this, and I get a sense that maybe you feel this too. Has some of the luster and some of the charm been taken out of sports because of these great stadiums that were and disappeared? But we have a few still left.
We do have a few still left, and thank God we do. I think it's really important that we maintain that link to sort of the history of the game and sort of the traditions of our fathers and our grandfathers. You're right. I think that some of the charm is gone. And it's not just, I think, because of nostalgia and sort of yearning for this place that we went to when we were younger, but also the way these stadiums are being built now. Neil DeMouse, who's a stadium critic and writes about stadium subsidies, he put it to me that these places are not better places to watch a game, but they're better places to sell you things. There's a corporate element that's been sneaking in for a long time, and now it's pretty obvious. I was just in Atlanta, and I got to check out SunTrust Park, the new Braves ballpark. And it's a great little ballpark, but you might as well be in a mall for all the little segmented, sponsored areas everywhere you go. And so, yeah, I think it's a little bit harder to form, this kind of lifelong emotional bond with the Pepsi porch as opposed to Forbes Field. And maybe that's just us being a little curmudgeonly. And as kids, grow up in this environment and they form their own emotions and memories, then they will have that bond to the Pepsi porch. We'll see.
Now, you live in New York City, and of course, I mentioned I grew up in Pittsburgh, but I want to go to the end of your book. I usually start at the beginning. I want to go to the end where, at the end of your book, you say, well, I'm ready to attend my next game, but I want to move that in a slightly different direction. If you had any game to attend, any stadium, go back in time if you want. Now that you've done all this research about stadiums and arenas, talked to so many people, put so much work into it, what stadium would you like to go to? Would it just be go back to old Yankee Stadium again?
I would love to attend another game at Old Yankee Stadium. I'll tell you what, I was at New Yankee Stadium last week, and I, you know, they say if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything, so I'll leave it there. But, wow, that's such a great question. And, you know, part of me just wants to say that, you know, as a New York fan, a New York sports fan, I wish I could be in attendance at the, you know, at the Aaron Boone home run game in the ALCS against the Red Sox in 2003. I mean, that, because, I mean, that for me, the emotional memory of that game and watching it live, you know, on a television set in St. Louis is still so vivid in my memory. But as you said, you know, given this sort of time machine to go back anywhere, wow. I mean, I would love to go to early days Lambeau and see the Ice Bowl. I mean, I wouldn't mind having, you know, a heating blanket if I were there.
In reality, the Packers were crowned world champions not in sunny Florida, but in the gelid confines of their own arena.
I would love to see Forbes Field. I would love to see Ebbets Field. I would love to see some of these really old, original ballparks, and in their original forms, as opposed to, you know, the way that they've been built up over time. Because of course, you know, we still have Wrigley and we still have Fenway, but they don't look anything like they looked when they were first built. And that'd be pretty cool to see the truly intimate 19-teens ballparks.
No doubt about it. So would I love to go back to see some of those. I've never been to Lambeau Field, by the way, even though many times on the air I'll do my John Facenda voice and do, you know, the frozen tundra. You mentioned it in your book, The Frozen Tundra of Lambeau Field, and that wonderful voice of John Facenda in the NFL films.
The game is a time warp where the young dream of growing up and the old remember youth. And for a few hours on Sunday, neither fantasy nor reminiscence seems foolish.
You start with Lambeau, and of course, that's a great place to start. We just had Mike Reed on Sports Jam recently. He played his rookie year, game number 3, against the Packers at Lambeau Field. He was a first-round draft pick of the Cincinnati Bengals. He said, I had 3 sacks in my first 2 games, and then we played the Packers at Lambeau Field. And he said, Doug, I don't remember hitting the ground. I just shook every play, getting hammered by the offensive line of the Green Bay Packers. I'm going to ask you still, why Lambeau first?
Well, Lambeau, you know, Lambeau has the mystique. You know, it's maybe the most of all the pro stadiums. It's the one that comes closest to having a college atmosphere. The town really rallies around the team and rallies around the venue in a way that just doesn't happen in quite the same sort of ownership capacity, you know, really emotional ownership over the team. But it's not just an emotional ownership, of course. As you no doubt know, you know, the team is community owned. That started with their first stock sale, and it's increased ever since. Every time they've opened it up for a stock sale again, most recently was, you know, I don't know, about six, seven years ago or so. And the team just has a kind of whimsy around it. There's they like almost like they can't believe that they have a pro football stadium here in Green Bay, Wisconsin, you know, home of 100,000 people. And against all rhyme or reason, when teams were falling off the map in the early days of the NFL, it persisted in Green Bay, not without trial. And you know, at one point, I wrote this in the book, Curly Lambeau even thought about turning them into a traveling team, believe it or not. But the team was saved by an infusion of TV money and building Lambeau Field. So I think there's something really special about that kind of unique American sports story that you can't really find anywhere else.
One of the great linebackers for the Green Bay Packers, Dave Robinson, was on Sports Jam talking about around Super Bowl time one year how everybody gets so excited about, you know, the Super Bowl and the spectacular things around these stadiums. He was in Super Bowl I. There was nobody there, basically. I mean, the stadium was pretty much empty at that point and just grew from there. Also, you know, when you went to these stadiums, this can happen, I think, sometimes. You're always going to be loyal to your favorite teams. But do you have something now special in your heart when you see the Packers play and they're at Lambeau Field and you watch maybe the Giants or the Jets playing them?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt. And in some ways, that's sort of that's something you acquire as, I think, a sports journalist. And maybe you've acquired the same. But anytime you spend time with a franchise or with an individual, you kind of you almost fall in love with them. You know, when the Kansas City Royals won the World Series, it was about 2 months after I spent a 9-game homestand with them. Of course, I didn't actually spend it with the players. I spent it with the fans and the mascots and the hot dog guys that run on the field. But I felt an absolute affinity to that team. In some ways, I almost wonder, you know, if we could get a point in our life where we can decide to like reset our fandom and just sort of, you know, try rooting for someone else for the different experience, because there is a different flavor for rooting for every team. You know, the Royals did not take that for granted when their team made the playoffs and when they made the World Series and then when they won it. And there's something really special about that. Obviously, you can't parachute into that because you need to have the history of that. But you gain an appreciation for it, 100%.
Rafi Cohan is the author of The Arena, Inside the Tailgating, Ticket Scalping, Mascot Racing, Dubiously Funded, and Possibly Haunted Monuments of American Sports. I tell students all the time, if you're going to be in sports, everybody loves stats, but make them mean something. The stats you put in your book are wonderful. I'm going to start with how many hot dogs at All-Star Weekend at Citi Field? 37,000 hot dogs.
Yeah, I mean, what an amazing number, right? And the chicken tenders and the pounds of shrimp. And I think you're right. Yeah, I mean, numbers on their face are just kind of soulless. But when we bring stories to them, when we remember what they mean, whether it's Ted Williams hitting 400 or DiMaggio hitting streak, then those numbers take on meaning for us personally, and they're endowed with something greater. So these numbers, these stadium numbers, I think that comes from a chapter where I talk about stadium logistics and operations, and that's from a section specifically about Citi Field and the food program there. And I just thought, what better way to really get a sense of the kind of volume that they have to deal with? You're talking about feeding tens of thousands of people over the course of a weekend or a homestand or whatever it is. And I mean, think about that. 37,000 hot dogs. I mean, what room would that fill? I really don't know, but it certainly would bring on raised cholesterol.
And another thing about that is it makes you realize, when you mention also the amount of people, 1,300 employees just for a Mets home game to spend on the concessions there. So you realize what a business that end of it really is. And you also talked about earlier here in the interview of how some of these stadiums, I will say it, abuse, with too many of the concessions and too much of it. It kind of just takes away some things. I wish it was just the vendor coming down with the hot dog and the cotton candy and the ice cold beer.
That'd be great, but that's not coming back. And Mike Landine, who is a top executive with the Mets and a great guy and someone who really brought me behind the scenes to show me around. He really was the architect of their food program there, but he made a very specific decision to scale back the number of in-seat vendors. They went from 300 at Shea to 100 at Citi Field, and there's a reason for that. It's because they want to get you out of your seat. They want you moving around. He calls it the mall mentality. They want you window shopping, seeing about this stand. Well, what about the press sandwiches over there? How about Shake Shack in center field? They want you moving, buying things. So I don't think we're going to get scaled back to anything less. You know, one thing that that I've come to think of as an interesting thought experiment is, now we're getting more amenities, swimming pools and stadiums and, all manner of craziness. But wouldn't it be cool if one city, one team decided to scale it back completely, to bring us back to sort of those early days of Lambeau, when it's just the metal bleachers and maybe a fitted plank into a stand selling peanuts and hot dogs? I mean, of course, they'll never do that because they want people coming there who aren't just sports fans. And once they're there, they want you buying more than just peanuts and hot dogs. But wouldn't that be a cool thing?
It would, and the people who come to the game could actually cheer for the teams because they'd be in the seats as they do that. Rafi Cohen is our guest here on Sports Jam. Let's go from the baseball stadium at Citi Field to Beaver Stadium, because since I graduated from Penn State, Beaver Stadium, I know it well. 106,000 plus capacity. It wasn't that much when I was going to Penn State in the 80s. They built onto that. But you had a quote here in the book: we park more cars on game day than Disney. That's another stat that really shows you what's going on.
It's just unbelievable, right? I mean, and you went to Penn State, so you understand State College is not a big city by any means. You know, I had another quote in there from Bobby Knight, who said, you know, going to Penn State isn't a road trip, it's a camping trip. And, you know, and it's true. What is it? It's a city of about 40,000, and on game days, they become the third largest municipality in the state of Pennsylvania. It's just out of control, the number of cars that come in. And, you know, there's no subway pulling up to Beaver Stadium. These are tens of thousands of cars, you know, turning intramural fields and literally animal pasture lands into makeshift tailgate grounds and parking lots and RV lots. And guess what? You make do. And it doesn't matter, because this becomes your sacred space. This becomes where you're going to spend those hours before Saturday kickoff. And it doesn't matter that if a cow was grazing here 2 days ago and he'll be back 2 days from now. Right now, this is about tailgating. It's about football. It's about tradition. And that's, yeah, I think that's an amazing thing that so many people go to this, well, not small stadium, but this big stadium in a small town in the middle of rural Pennsylvania, that they can literally rival Disney in terms of parked cars.
As a freelance writer, you've written for GQ, Men's Journal, Wall Street Journal, Town and Country, ESPN.com, and many more. You're a sports journalist. You're a journalist to begin with. So you don't go into Penn State with blinders. It's 2017, and we all know the problems that Penn State has faced, and you bring them up. And, in fact, you bring them up in so many important facts about so many of the places that I love history. So I think you kind of owed it to the readers to tell them about that. You must have felt the same way.
Absolutely. You know, none of this exists in a vacuum. And, I mean, if we're talking about Penn State specifically, you know, that's a big part of what's going to inform fandom there in the post-Sandusky years. I mean, one of the most interesting things that I learned about college stadiums in particular was the way that from the very beginning, these stadiums served as almost billboards to the wider nation about, you know, about what these institutions stood for and what this community represented. It was a sort of stake in the ground to say, this is an institution that matters. And over the years, that has, you know, that sort of legacy has been reinvested in those buildings by who shows up and, you know, the traditions of the football program, the traditions of the institutions themselves. And they come to stand as kinds of metaphors for what that community and that institution believes about itself. And at Penn State, as you know, there was a very strong belief of what this, you know, what the stadium represented and what the school represented. And, of course, that sort of rug was pulled out from under them in from the Sandusky scandal. So you have to talk about that, because we're at a time where people are sort of trying to re-understand what it means to be a Penn State fan. And no, it's not a stain by association. You know, just because you root for Penn State doesn't mean that you're somehow complicit in all this. But it's really hard to negotiate, you know, to navigate that, I think, as a fan. And so I think it was important to provide that context. And as you said, the context for all these things, because sports also don't exist in a vacuum. You know, there's political consequence, there's cultural consequence, there's economic consequence, and, you know, there's emotional consequence for us as fans as well. So I think all of that sort of needs to be taken into consideration when we're sort of stirring up this stew of what it means to be an American sports fan.
With we mentioning you talking about a book around sports, you talked to some really interesting characters. Even ticket scalping has changed so much through the years. But of all the people you talked to, who was your favorite and why?
Well, my favorite, has to be the amazing Slotik. That's not his real name. His real name is Gary Borstelman. He's from Long Island, and he is an NBA halftime performer. But that only happened recently in Gary's life. He spent 30-plus years as a circus performer, paying his dues, traveling around the country in an RV, in a trailer, and just living week to week, you know, performing under the big top. He really had no dreams of becoming an NBA halftime act, even though the circus serves as a kind of feeder school for halftime performers. That's something that I never knew. And he is just the most over-the-top character you'll ever meet, the most enthusiastic, the happiest, takes nothing for granted, and just a madman. He made me ride the Cyclone with him in Coney Island, and I'm not a roller coaster guy in my, you know, as I've gone on in years. I used to love him, but he was sticking out his stomach to try and gain as much purchase so that he could stand up during the ride. And meanwhile, I'm trying to sit back as far as possible so that we can jam this bar close to us. And he even had me eventually assist him on center court during his act. And I've neglected to mention that his act is that he stacks 6 chairs on top of one another, on top of a folding table, till he's about 25 feet in the air. And then he does handstands on top of the tower of chairs. And so I literally had to, you know, hand him the chairs and, you know, lift the chairs up with a thin metal pole, which, by the way, is much more top-heavy than you'd imagine. All the while, I am absolutely terrified that I'm going to kill him. But he, you know, he was a good sport and, you know, went along with it. And, you know, Gary's had some trials in his life, too, that he's overcome and redeemed himself from. And so I don't want to give away too much, but suffice to say, Gary's my favorite.
Welcome to Prudential Center. Get your jersey on and get ready for Devils hockey.
And you take us to Prudential Center, which is a 10-minute walk from where we are at WBGO. You help put the ice in, and that's always a fascinating thing that a lot of people don't get to see, you know. And I found it interesting that it is a pain in the neck after some events.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these are the, you know, the phantoms of the arena, you know, the shadow hours workers that they have to transform this space when no one else is watching. And it can be very difficult. I mean, you have after game, you have marketing events on the ice that, you know, can kind of, you know, constrict you in one direction time-wise, but then you have a deadline you have to hit in the other way. And there's a lot of just logistics in terms of what has to go where, when, how the building's set up in terms of where you bring the seats out from and where you're bringing them to. You don't want to get stuck, you know, having one part out, you know, before another part, and then, you know, you're just jammed up for the rest of the night. And it's not just logistics. Sometimes it's absolutely just a fire drill. And, you know, there are times when Prudential Center has an event or a game, you know, in the afternoon and then another one at night. And, you know, they've got to flip that building in about 2-3 hours. And that is no small task. And, you know, the guys I spent time with, they'll tell you, well, it really doesn't happen as quickly even as we say we can do it. But they always get it done.
Do you like Prudential Center? Do you like where it's located? There's always been controversy over whether it would work in the city of Newark.
Well, I would wonder if it is working. I don't know. I've always enjoyed going to Prudential Center, and I've come. I grew up in New Jersey. I grew up in South Orange, and I think if Prudential Center was around more then, I probably would have spent even more time. Now I live in Brooklyn, so I take the train in when I'm going to Prudential Center, and I've always enjoyed the games. I probably haven't spent as much time as I should around Prudential Center. Prudential Center to understand how things are changing and, you know, what kind of nightlife there might be or restaurants, because, you know, that's a big factor in terms of what kind of, you know, cast off business you get from a stadium. But, you know, I interviewed Scott O'Neill, Hugh Weber, you know, the owners of the part of the ownership group for Prudential Center. And one of the things that always stuck with me from what they told me is that they didn't want this to be a New York building when they took it over. They wanted it to be a New Jersey building. You know, you're not competing with Madison Square Garden. You're not competing with Barclays Center. This is a place for New Jerseyans to come, you know, for New Jersey to come together. It's why there's, you know, sort of all the boardwalk food and why Bruce Springsteen's playing after the final whistle. And, you know, I don't know what's happening with that sort of marketing effort and whether it's striking a chord or not, but at least it resonated with me because it seemed at least like it was a smart idea. Because as someone from New Jersey, even though I live in New York, I have a tremendous amount of Jersey pride. And absolutely, I don't need to my arena to be the third New York arena. It's the first New Jersey arena. And I hope people are coming out for it. I know when the Nets left, there weren't as many events. But, you know, I think it's a good place to see a game. And I'll go to a Devils game, you know, anytime.
Obviously, the Nets went to Brooklyn, Barclays Center. Your thoughts on that? There's been a lot of controversy with the Islanders. But how about just the fact that, how do you see Barclays?
Barclays Center is an interesting place. I have mixed feelings about it. I think it's a great place to see a game from certain places in the arena. And it's a much worse place to see a game from other places in the arena. The upper deck is very far from the court, even though they sort of stacked it at a high angle, sort of like the old upper deck at Yankee Stadium. So you could feel like you're sort of towering over the, you know, over the playing field. They also pushed it back in a way that it wasn't at Yankee Stadium, and they also put two levels of luxury suites in between. So you feel much further away, and you almost feel like you're getting vertigo. That being said, it's a super cool place. I mean, the food is great there. I'm not sure if Carla Hall is still doing her chicken sandwiches out of Barclays, but it is worth a trip there just for that. The vault suites, you know, is not something that everyone's going to get to do, but they have this kind of cool, chic atmosphere in Barclays Center, and they get a lot of cool events. But ultimately, I think time will tell what Barclays becomes, because right now there's not really a fan base for the Nets, and there's not really a fan base, you know, well, the Islanders aren't staying anyway, so it doesn't matter. But I think time will tell as, you know, as sort of the generations move on, and if a real fan base starts to take root, that will give the place character and give it something more than just a hip, trendy flavor, which ultimately, how long can that last?
Let's give you the title of expert on arenas and stadiums after writing the book, The Arena. MetLife Stadium. Does it work? Jets, Giants in the same building?
Well, as a Giants fan, I was sad to see the stadium named Giants Stadium go away, because it always felt like a great sort of big brother advantage over the Jets. I certainly think it makes sense in terms of just economy of space. You know, you're building a $1 billion+ facility. Why wouldn't you share it with another team when you're only taking up 10 days a year? I mean, wouldn't it be a little silly to have $2 billion facilities in a stone's throw from one another? I think they do it in a smart way. It was kind of cool seeing like where all the Giants stuff was hidden when I went to a Jets game. In some ways, as I said, it felt like it would feel like almost like the team was cheating on me if I knew all of that stuff. But I think it works. I think ultimately it's a little bit without character because they could not commit to, you know, a particular color scheme, so everything has to be gray. But, you know, the way they say it is the fans bring the color, and ultimately that's true everywhere. So I think it does work. I don't know if I'm a stadium expert. I'd say I'm a stadium observer. I just, you know, I tried to take it all in.
One of the perks of doing the arena, you get to trim the ivy at Wrigley Field. What's going on with that? How was that experience?
Oh, man, that was amazing. That, and, you know, I got to paint the mound at Fenway Park, too. I didn't write about that. There was a lot of cool things that I got to do. I got to ride the Olympic bobsled track out in Salt Lake City. I got to shoot a T-shirt cannon at a Rutgers game. All these things, by the way, were things that didn't even make it into the book. And, you know, Wrigley was super cool, and it was just serendipity that I got to do it. But really, all of these things, the ones I've written about and not, you know, hopefully informed the writing of this book in a way that I hope translates to the reader, that you can almost feel like you're getting to experience them yourself, not just for those experiences, but ultimately sort of going to a game. How is that experience transformed after knowing all of these things? Because for me, it absolutely was transformative. I went to a game, you know, last year after finishing my reporting of the book, and it was almost like I could see the Matrix, you know, I can look on the field and I see the grass and I'm like, oh, I know where that comes from, like what sod farm that comes from. And I see them raking the dirt and I know how they prepared that. And I see the beers flowing and I know what beer pump room they come from. I see the pump up jams on the scoreboard and I know, you know, what producer's playing them and I can take a guess as to why. And you sort of see how everything is connected in a way that I never really appreciated before. And in that way it kind of answered my question, my initial question, which was exploring these worlds as a way to sort of inform myself as a fan. I think that was the goal, and at least for me personally, I think it actually worked.
You're not only a fan, but you still participate in sports. In fact, you hurt yourself recently playing basketball. What was the first sport that you played, and did you play high school sports?
The first sport I played was probably just soccer, you know, kicking around the ball as a two-year-old. I did play high school sports. I went to school in West Orange, and I played soccer, basketball, and baseball. My best sport was probably baseball. I played outfield, and I pitched when we needed it.
So you had a good arm then, obviously.
I had an okay arm. I had a knuckle curve, which at least the first time someone would see it would usually take them by surprise because they thought it was going to hit him in the head, and then it would slowly drop toward the strike zone.
You played left field. Left field usually means you're a good hitter.
I was a good hitter. I made first team All-State Prep B division for my junior year of high school. I think I hit something around 455. So I'm a solid line drive hitter.
What was the first article you remember writing that had any significance to you?
I remember writing an article in high school called The Art of Hall Wandering. And it was because I would wander the halls often. And an English teacher of mine was trying to get me to write for the paper. And I said, I don't know what I'm going to write. And he said, well, you always are in the halls. Why don't you talk about that? So I just basically took everyone on a journey through my thoughts as I wandered the halls and how to get out of class and the best routes to take so you would encounter the fewest amount of teachers along the way. And you know, I had a really good time doing that. So I guess it stuck with me.
Yeah, if you think about it, you've kind of come full circle there because your latest book, The Arena, is you take us to hallways and tunnels and things, and you tell us how they impact you.
That's really very perceptive. That's 100% right, because this book absolutely, as we said, is more so than, you know, the football field or the baseball diamond or the hard court. Is so much more about those service tunnels, those back of house corridors, those mazes that you never really see. I like being in the hallways.
So what's the next project for Rafi Cohen?
I'm not sure what my next project is. I'm, you know, I've got a few balls in the air. I'm very interested in a couple things related to sports and a couple that are not. So I just might need to see what gets a nibble.
So what were these ideas you mentioned when you were all the way as a youngster? You know, somebody helped and said, well, why don't you write about this? Where does that spark come now for you?
Well, I think, you know, you just have to have a genuine interest in something. But, I mean, so much is just listening to people, listening and reading. And you never know. Someone, you know, I had a friend who was talking to me about, you know, youth tennis tournaments and sort of the weird milieu that exists between the parents at these tournaments. And I don't know if that'll turn into a project of some sort, but That's one thing that interested me now, and it literally came from nothing more than talking to my friend Mike, who takes his daughter Bella to all of these tennis tournaments around the Upper Midwest.
You mentioned that in your book you did so many interviews and enjoy talking to people. As we wrap up this edition of Sports Jam, what would be the best compliment you would get from somebody reading The Arena?
I don't know. The best compliment. I mean, the best compliment would just, if you read it, I'll take that as a compliment. That's good enough. You know, I think if someone were to read it and tell me that they're seeing sports in a different way, or they're just thinking differently about themselves as a fan or the people they encounter at a stadium, I think that would be a huge compliment, because I think ultimately that's kind of the goal, is just kind of sort of to expand our thought when it comes to these venues, how we look at them, how we experience them, how we interact with them.
You basically answered the question. Last one, I promise you, is that you see, oh yeah, I know where that is made, where that came from. But what did you specifically learn from writing this book?
Well, I think ultimately I had three main takeaways. The first is economics related, because obviously, you know, public subsidies are a big issue now. And that is, all the evidence suggests that stadiums are not good economic drivers, especially not for a region at large. There might be some targeted development that works, but in general, they're not good economic drivers. That's not an argument we should buy. At the same time, that doesn't mean there's no value to stadiums when it comes to things like quality of life and civic pride. And so if we as communities are thinking about spending money on these facilities, we should be having honest conversations about them, not believing that they're going to make us rich, but maybe they will enrich us. And so if we're having those conversations and we decide it's something we want to do, by all means, that's your prerogative. The second thing I learned, this might be the number one lesson learned from spending a year on the road visiting stadiums, and that is pee every chance you get. There is no commodity that is in higher demand on game day than an empty bladder. So hydrate well and then pee every chance you get. And then the third takeaway is one that you alluded to earlier, which is how I really end the book. And that is the best way to watch a game, because I've seen it now from a lot of angles. And the best way to watch a game, you know, not the owner's box, not the cheap seats, you know, the bleachers with the bleacher creatures and the drunks. It could be, but not necessarily. The best place to watch a game, the best way to watch a game, is with someone who cares about the game, with a fan, with someone who passionately cares about the outcome. Because ultimately, that's why we go, and that's why we watch sports, is because we're invested. And so if you're watching with someone who cares about the game, then you're going to have a great time. And that's really all that matters.
And you can hear the passion of author Rafi Cohen. His new book just out, The Arena Inside, The Tailgating, Ticket Scalping, Mascot Racing, Dubiously Funded and Possibly Haunted Monuments of American Sport. It is out on Live Right, part of Norton Books. We appreciate you spending time on Sports Jam. Hope your hand gets better soon so we can see you back out on the basketball courts.
Can't wait to get out on the courts.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out all the podcasts by going to WBGO.org/Sports Jam or find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on iTunes. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll see you at the game.